Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Senior Judge J. Clifford Wallace of the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. He is the recipient in 2008 of the University of California Berkeley School of Law Judge D. Lowell and Barbara Jensen Public Service Award. Judge Wallace, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you very much.
Where were you born and raised?
San Diego in both instances.
And looking back, how did your childhood shape your thinking about the world, do you think? What did you learn?
I learned how to survive primarily. I grew up in a poor area of San Diego. My father was an immigrant and had a third grade education and suffered from alcoholism. He had difficulty supporting us. My mother was a high school dropout, a very fine person, but she had her own series of challenges. So I don't think there was much that happened in my home, nor particularly in school, and that wasn't the school's fault either. I was just in an area and ran with people that didn't put much high mark on going to school or education or otherwise. As a matter of fact, I went all the way through high school without ever reading a book. I found you could always get a C or a D just by reading the book cover and saying something. So I was not an achiever at all. But someplace along the line, I got the idea I wanted to be a lawyer. And never having met a lawyer is rather striking. But all the time I wanted to be a lawyer, but it never computed that you have to do something to do that. Mm-hmm. And 3 years in the Navy helped me out. I qualified to go to a school for a year under the Secretary of Navy's Annapolis program and getting ready to take the exam. So while other people were brushing up, I was learning for the first time. Mm-hmm. At the end of that year, I'd done all my high school work that I didn't do earlier. And although I received an appointment to go to the Naval Academy, I decided against it because I decided it was better off if I continued my process of going towards law, and I did. I came back and went to San Diego State University and ended up at Berkeley.
In the law program. So it's a fascinating story, and I'm curious, what are there any influences that shaped your character that you can look back now? See, I mean, clearly from what you just said, you had intelligence going for you. What else?
Well, I wasn't aware of that. I think I came to grips with that I am an individual, that I have purpose, I have responsibility, and that there's a certain vision of life that I got. And it was primarily finding a religion with which I was compatible and got me to start thinking in those lines. So I give a lot of credit to that in shaping my view and in shaping my service. The idea of being of service to other people came a lot out of that experience.
Mm-hmm. I think our audience would be interested to know, what do you think are the skills required to be a lawyer?
Well, essentially, you have to really care about what you're doing and not just how much money you're taking to the bank. It's a service organization. We're doing something for people they can't do. It's hard work. You have to be willing to put in the time, whether you get paid for it or not. There has to be a feeling of accomplishment, of being of help to people. And then secondarily is of course taking care of your family, and that's helpful. That's important too. It's problem solving, and so to the extent people can learn how to solve problems, it's helpful. For example, they did a study on what undergraduate courses help the most to be a lawyer, and I always thought it was economics and poli sci, and so I went through that. But it turns out to be math. So I think those skills are necessary. But a person has to be dedicated to a goal. I think that helps a lot in making success of the law and making it fulfilling for your life.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about history and a sense of the broader society? For students, would the taking of history to understand, for example, the history of the Constitution, of the nature of our political system, and so on?
I think that's a fair statement, that looking at the Constitution and the framers and understanding better what they were trying to accomplish gives you a better feeling, a setting of what the law is all about. And certainly later on, as your view broadens, there's a lot of catch-up that takes place of things that you didn't study because you didn't think they were that important. Now they become rather critical in what you're trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that your religion was important to you. Is that the source of notions of equity and justice, or is it philosophy that you have to turn to as you're weighing the pros and cons of the arguments in a particular case?
It'll impact on all of those things, but for my purpose, it was just becoming sensitive that I'm supposed to be doing something, that I should be doing something with my life, that I can be of help, that I can be creative, that I can show some leadership, and that I would be disappointed in me after that if I didn't do the work necessary to accomplish that.
But what about as you look at a particular case, does your religion help you find that notion of justice and equity as you weigh both sides of the argument, or is it really just the logic and the precedents that you have before you and the particular facts of the case?
I'm sure that it has some indirect values. But one of the things that you learn to do is you must be guided by the law. And it's the Constitution, the statutes of the Congress that we must apply, not shaping them to our view of what society or whatever should be. So in that regard, one has to be careful. Someone asked me one time, if you had to decide a case and it was against the tenets of your church, but consistent with the Constitution, what would you do? Well, that was an easy answer for me. You'd follow the Constitution. Mm-hmm. That's where I've taken my oath. If I can't do that, I should step down. So it has an indirect influence on you to the extent it teaches that we should be looking outside ourselves to be of help, things like that. But our main goal is to apply the Constitution and the statutes, and we can't allow anything outside of that, even no matter how virtuous they are, to be an influence. That's what people expect of us, or should expect of us.
I guess as a judge and as an attorney, you really have to have a command of the English language. You need to know how to write well and write clearly so people will understand what you're saying. Talk a little about that, and where did you get this sense of the importance of words and of writing at law school?
I think as an undergraduate, I think as I was going through San Diego State University, I became aware of that and became very fascinated with the idea of developing ideas and being able to develop them crisply and yet carry meaning. And I became impressed with the idea that it is not my goal to write to be understood. It's to write so that I'll never be misunderstood. Mm-hmm. And that takes a lot of writing. And I became very aware there are not good writers, they're good editors. And one has to be able to constantly relook at their work to make it more effective. And that takes time. That takes time. But with skills that you pick up, it isn't insurmountable, but it is time-consuming.
After you graduated from law school, you practiced law in San Diego, and talk a little about that. In other words, what was that learning experience like? What kind of cases did you handle and so on, and how long did you do it?
It was an exciting part of my life. I was very fortunate. The major firm in San Diego selected me, I think a lot because I went to Berkeley, and they've had good experience with Berkeley graduates. But these firms were very small in those days. And I wanted to be a trial lawyer, and they gave me that opportunity. So I was primarily a civil trial lawyer for 15 years before I went on the bench. And I didn't leave the practice of law because I didn't like it. There's a lot of things I miss about the practice of law. But I enjoyed it. It brought out the better things in me. It required me to do far more than I thought I was capable of. And that was a very good experience for me. Going into trial, representing people, it's a fascinating thing that you do. You're doing something they can't do for themselves, and you want to do it well. And it was, I enjoyed that part of the law very much.
And were you involved on the side in politics at all, or did you just practice the law?
I just practiced law. There were a few things that helping out, doing a few things committee, but between raising a family, which was my first priority, and my religious involvement and practicing law, there wasn't much time left, and I never played golf or went fishing. It was 24 hours a day keeping up. But that was good for me. That was good for me, too. It learned, it taught me a discipline that I got more out of life. Mm-hmm. But I learned most of that at Berkeley, mm-hmm. where I never went to the drinking fountain and sat and talked to people. I went down and got into the books again. Discipline was something I learned in law school.
Mm-hmm. And hard work, I guess.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Is there any one experience when you were a practicing attorney that something clicked in your mind that has kind of enhanced your ability as a judge, some recollection, or it was just the whole body of the experience?
I think it was the whole experience. I had in the back of my mind someday I might want to go on the bench, but I had turned it down several times to go on the state bench. The federal bench is a different type of work, much more consistent with what I wanted to do. I actually went on a little earlier than I would have preferred. I was 41 when I went on the district court.
And that would be what year?
1970.
Okay.
And I was just in a partnership where I was beginning to make some money after struggling along. And it was a time that was not the most convenient for me. But a partner from another law firm came to me and said, this opportunity is here. We'd like to have you take it. And we gave it serious consideration, decided to do it.
And you were appointed to the district court by President Nixon. And then where were you based, in San Diego?
I was. I was in the Southern District of California, and the courthouse there is in downtown San Diego. Then 2 years later, one of my colleagues on the Court of Appeals was going senior, and he wanted me to take his place, and I got another telephone call whether I'd be willing to go on the Court of Appeals, so I did in 1972.
Mm-hmm. And that you were also appointed by President Nixon.
Yes.
To that, yeah. And conceptually these courts differ? In other words, as a district judge, you are lower in the hierarchy of the court system, the federal court system. What is the breadth of the kind of cases that come before you? And are they closer to real human beings and their conflicts and so on in that sense?
Yes, they certainly are. Anything that's a federal crime or a federal civil matter, anything of federal jurisdiction, it came before us. And, of course, we're next to the border, so we had a lot of crime. And I had never even tried a criminal case before then, so that was a new area. There wasn't much of a change of going from being a lawyer to being a trial judge. I developed that fairly easy, and the criminal law is not difficult. The civil law is more difficult. I had been working with civil law, so I didn't find it a big transition to go there. And it was nice, and I enjoyed doing that. But the thing that struck me about going to the Court of Appeals was I could change my primary skill. My primary skill was oral when I was a trial lawyer and as a trial judge. Now if I go to the Court of Appeals, it'll be written skills. And I just thought that'd be an interesting challenge to see the broader picture of establishing the fabric of the law would be something I would enjoy, and it turned out I did.
Mm-hmm. And talk a little about the dynamics on an appeal court. Now, let me ask this first. Tell us, you are on the Ninth Circuit. Where is the Ninth Circuit? Where do the cases come from that you deal with?
The Ninth Circuit is the nine western states and the islands of the Pacific. It's the largest circuit in the United States, has about 55, 60 million people within the circuit. The cases come from the district court, the trial court, and also from the agencies, federal agencies. They also have an access to our court. So that's where our jurisdiction is. It's a very dynamic area. We have more diversity than any other circuit. Unfortunately, we have more cases, too, and that creates some problems. But it's very meaningful, the types of cases, the types of issues. I've never been bored.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the diversity within the courts covered by the we're going to talk about this a little later about the work you've done in trying to bring diversity to the court system. But talk a little about how your sensitivity to issues of diversity emerged. Was it through the nature of the cases that you were getting? Was it the political dynamic in the country and so on, or what?
The political dynamic never entered at all. I was never asked once how I'd vote on a particular issue. Mm-hmm. In those early days, they had some way of finding you, but it was largely the people who had achieved within the profession and were willing to take the necessary sacrifice in salary in order to go on the bench. So that wasn't the issue. What really took place was all of a sudden, instead of finding the law to apply it, I was going to apply the law. And I found that there were a lot of areas where it wasn't clear. Mm. And what you were trying to do was decide what that law should be. Now, some feel that the court should be a social instrument for change. I never believed that. I believe too much in democracy. The people don't always get it right, but that there's a dynamic to letting people make those decisions. So I have been in the group of judges which they call judicial restraint judges. That's neither conservative nor liberal. It's just how you approach your task. And as I worked longer and longer within being an appellate judge, this became more and more significant to me on how I approach problems that come to us. And all my brothers and sisters on the court don't feel the same way I do. Some of them feel the other way, and that's okay. I don't think it's the way that we were supposed to be as judges. So there's still a great disagreement across the United States among judges and among law professors and others. What is the real role of a judge? Is a judge someone, when they don't get it right through the democratic process, we fix it? Or do we require the democratic process to move forward and get the job done, and we just make application of the law itself? Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting question.
And I want to explore this, but as part of to give a fuller sense of what a judge does, as I listen to you, you remind me of the philosophers who I've had on this program, in the sense a philosopher will tell me, well, what we try to do is bring order to the chaos of a particular phenomena. And it sounds to me that, is it fair to say that you're saying in a way that there are areas where the law is not clear about what should be done, but this, in your view, is not about, you know, making political decisions, but rather coming up with rules that will sort out a particular area and offer a greater definition of where one can go and where one can't go. That's maybe superficial, but is that, can we help our audience understand what it is you're sorting out as you decide a case at the appellate level?
Well, as an example, the Congress isn't always as careful as they ought to be with their legislation. I understand that. They have to go through compromises, and they have much too much work to do. But it leaves certain gaps as to what is meant. And then they come to court because there's a dispute, and we have to make a decision. What is the law going to be? What is the rule going to be? And then it depends on how you go about doing that. Do you look at some view that you have of the way society should be, or do you look and try and find out what it is the legislature had in mind? And then whether you agree with what the legislature did or not is not the issue. The issue is, does that rule, is it consistent with what they were trying, the elected representatives were trying to do? And to that extent, you're developing a less chaos because you're establishing rules. They may not be rules that you like. They may not be rules that Congress likes. But they can always amend their statutes, so that's not a problem. If you get it wrong, they have the great erasure, and they can take care of it. But that's, I think there's a lot to that, that to the extent we're able to define what they have made unclear, there's less chaos in the world.
Now, you know, of course, the Berkeley tradition, with you, which you know, is activism and social change and so on. But you're suggesting that you fall in the category of judges who want to defer to the legislature. And what are the rules about drawing that line? I mean, are there criteria in your mind that help you navigate this area where you're trying to clarify the rules on the one hand, but I think what you're saying is you don't want to make the rules or the law, you want to defer to the legislature?
Yes. I think there's times when you can't tell whether a person believes in judicial restraint or judicial activism, but certainly the approach is different. And the idea behind what I like to call judicial restraint is that it gives the greatest opportunity for democracy to work. Now, it's slower, I understand that, and people get concerned. They want to do an end run around the democratic process and get to the courts. But the Constitution wasn't made to solve all problems. It's very small. And the idea behind the Constitution was to restrict the national government. And those rules were ones that would allow this great democratic force to start, not only through the states, but the national government as well. So I don't see this as judicial restraint as one in which your foot is on the brake pedal. On the contrary, I think what it does is excite the democratic process to get people to get out and get involved. Now, we haven't done very well in that as a country. I mean, look at how many people come out to vote. We say we're a democracy, but we haven't been able to catch the view that it really matters, that one vote. And I think it's best for the United States to move in that direction. I just believe. Well, it's like Winston Churchill said, the democracy is absolutely the worst type of government there is, except for all others that have been tried. It's not perfect, but I think it's best for the people. So my philosophy, my judicial philosophy, is consistent with that approach.
Mm-hmm. Now, over the years that you've been a lawyer, a judge at the district level and then at the circuit court level, the judiciary, in a way, has become a kind of a football, a political football, and there have been a lot of complaints about politicization, some of them more than complaints and so on. Talk about this era that you've lived through as a judge, and what are the factors that help the system right itself, restore the balance? Is it the fact that parties are in power at different times, and it's about the election of our leaders who then right the balance on particular issues?
There's been a substantial change in the way federal judges are selected now. When I went on the bench in the 70s, of course the president was going to pick people from his own party, most of the time. Richard Nixon didn't. He picked Democrats as well as Republicans, but most of them would pick from their own party. The question is, do you want somebody who is going to be have the views of society that you have, or are you looking for a good lawyer? Now, in the early days, they looked for the good lawyer. What was most important was the ABA going out and making sure you're a good lawyer, and of course the FBI to make sure you weren't a crook someplace. But that was, there was no question asked of me of that. I didn't fill out any forms. And when I went back to the Congress, no one asked me how I would vote on abortion or how I'd vote on this or that. That was not part of the process. Now, over a period of time, that changed, where presidents felt that they wanted to get people that had their view of society. And so there would be these litmus tests and things like that. And so it became very politicized because they wanted that kind of a judge. And then those judges would come on and say, I've got a mission to change. And it skewed the whole process, in my view. Now, that's true of Republicans, it's true of Democrats. It turned into a process in which they not only politicized, but they looked at the jury, at the judiciary, as a way of achieving a certain goal politically, sociologically, as they saw it. And I think that's been very unfortunate. I think that it's damaged our judiciary, and I think it's caused the judiciary to look at itself in a different way, and I think a way that is not consistent with what the founders had in mind, nor what's best for America.
So your ideal, it sounds like, and I think you're arguing that this was really the tradition until the, you know, the more recent times, was a kind of insulation of the judiciary from the political process, which then empowers it to do this sorting out of the rules based on the law that's been created by the democratic process.
Yeah, yes.
Interesting. So how then do you sort of navigate the system back? Let's assume that we want the audience wanted to buy into what you're saying, the way the judiciary was in the past. How does one best achieve that return to the kind of vision that you had and that really was the way the courts worked in an earlier period?
Well, I think it's going to take an educational process. I just don't. I mean, if you talk to the average person, what they want the court to do is make a decision they like, not one that's consistent with some other goals. And to get the view of what a judiciary, what will be the best type of judiciary for the future, it's going to require an educational process. Now, whether that's going to take place in high school and college or whether it's going to take place through the media, I have no way of knowing. But it will take a change of view. Politicians react to majorities. If the politician feels this isn't the way they want judges selected, there's less likelihood they're going to go that direction. And that's right. That's the way it should be. So until the people become interested in making those kinds of modifications, I don't see much happening. Now and then there'll be a convert to my view. I remember when I made my first determination on this that I was going to come out and talk about it, I gave a lecture at George Washington University called The Jurisprudence of Judicial Restraint, A Return to the Moorings. Mm-hmm. And that was how I felt about it. Mm-hmm. We were returning to something that we should get to. And I would like to see more people involved.
Now, as part of this education process, it would seem that the people, the activists, the community that wants change, you know, now and doesn't want to wait. And I think this is true, one could say, of both the right and the left.
Oh, there's no question.
Yeah. So what is the handle for making those constituencies understand the costs of what they're proposing, because they may win today, I think you're saying, if the courts get politicized. But then the pendulum will swing the other way, and then everybody says, well, we can't trust the judges because they've been politicized.
Yeah. I think it's just a question of seeing what they're asking for. For example, they're saying, I believe in judicial activism, but only if it's activists in my point of view. And, for example, suppose all nine members of the Supreme Court, this will never happen, suppose all nine members of the Supreme Court belong to the Ku Klux Klan. Would you want that court to be activistic? Well, the answer is no, you wouldn't want them. Well, that means that it's a result-oriented philosophy. Judicial activism is result-oriented. And there are conservative judicial activists and there are liberal judicial activists. So if people can understand that they may want activists, but they only want them if they'll go the direction and maybe they won't have them, then they may think about, is there a better way? What in a grand scheme of things, what's the best way for us to have governance in our country? And maybe when we ask those questions, we'll come out with a different answer.
You were the chief judge for a number of years.
Five years.
5 years from what year to what year?
91 to 96.
And in that capacity, you are also an administrator of the court, the chief.
I was.
What is involved in those tasks?
The administration is what makes the machine work. And most judges don't care much for administration. They like to be on the bench. In the early 70s, I got interested in judicial administration. I started studying it, writing it, and even taught courses in judicial administration. So by the time I became chief judge of the largest circuit, I had a tremendously interesting challenge, and we made a lot of progress in my judgment. You continue to be a judge, you continue to sit on cases, but you get to deal with how can you make the process better, that is, how can you get the cases through quicker, how can you provide the necessary things to make us more efficient, more effective. It's a little like going into a business. You sort of look at what your stock is and how you can best get it out. Now, we get chief judges by staying the longer. So it's a little sometimes like getting a good teacher and making him a principal and they fail. There's no test you take to be a chief judge. Some like it better than others. But it is an exciting time, and we did some interesting things that I really enjoyed.
And what does it take to reform the courts in the capacity that you have? Can you give an example of something that you want done and you were able to do it? Is it just by virtue of the power of your role, or is it by virtue of your ability to persuade your colleagues or the courts under you to follow?
I wish it were by the power. It would have been much easier. And, you know, when you're a chief judge, it's a little like herding cats. Keeping them together in one group is very difficult. And you have to have a critical mass of the court in favor. So it is talking to people, getting people convinced. And that means it's slower. There's none of them you can fire. You're not running General Motors. So you deal with what you've got, and you try and move towards the process. Now, it wasn't very often that I had a 100% unanimity of these views because it required judges to change what they're doing. And judges are very conservative. Most conservative people, maybe lawyers too, once they do something, they want to continue the way they're doing it. And they keep saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I would say, is there a better way? And the two philosophies have a tendency to collide. But I think as we continued to work together on these issues, we did some remarkable things during those 5 years. I'm very pleased with what my colleagues on the court allowed us to do.
Now, one of the issues that in your role as a court leader, both on the Ninth Circuit and in the judicial system, and your role as an administrator, you've actually been involved in bringing issues to the table, I think, as part of the organization. And so you've been very active in bringing greater diversity to the court system. I assume in terms of judges and personnel and the way the courts act and things. Talk a little about that and what was the obstacle there, the sense that the country wasn't prepared for the challenge of diversity. I'm not talking about places like the Bay Area or California. And so
no, we had that same process. I think the one thing that we had to make clear that we hire people and they're retained for their abilities, not for their own social views or their own particular ways of living, so long as they create an example on the court that gives what the judiciary example should be. And we did, I think, a very good job with that. We have a very large clerk's office, and if you walked in there and talked to people, you would see a very diverse group. The more difficult process was trying to figure out what do we owe to the people as far as the courts are concerned, the judges are concerned, the system itself. And just before I came on, we had started this effort to find out whether or not there's gender fairness, and that was just coming to an end. And we were very successful in that. And so my role was taking a second step of race, religion, and ethnicity. And we had a task force that we put together. I had to talk to a lot of judges to make sure that I wasn't going to get a lot of opposition and let them know why I'm doing what I'm doing. And we got David Levy, who is now dean of law school at Duke. He was a judge. His father was attorney general. He's a very bright guy, and he agreed to chair that task force. And it was very successful. But those are the kinds of issues to see if there are any headwinds within the court system. We can't solve everything in the world, but we can make sure our court system is as pure as it can be. And that was a good experience. I enjoyed that.
And were there any particular obstacles to this? Or in other words, I guess in a way what we're saying is that when the country faces a challenge, the court system is a microcosm within that when we're talking about reforming itself. And it with the right leadership, it can adapt.
Yes. And we just have to make sure. And very often we're doing things inadvertently. For example, a judge says, Mr. Smith, what's your position on this? Mary, what's your position? Now, he doesn't mean to push the gender button, but it's just people got used to doing those things. And what we had to do is call it to their attention so they just give thought to it. And the judges are fine people, but they too have to be reminded that they are setting an example for the judiciary, and if inadvertently they do something, it reflects on all of the judiciary.
Now, I know one of your great achievements in public service has been the work with court systems abroad, and I think that you were involved in this process, an active leader with Chief Justice Berger for establishing the American Inns of Court. Explain what that was and what you were trying to achieve.
Chief Justice Berger believed in change, and he was leading a team in an Anglo-American exchange. He invited me to the team. Lord Diplock had the English side, and we were looking at procedure. The result was that we visited the English Inns of Court. Chief Justice Berger and I were sitting in the bus waiting for the rest of the group to come one morning, and I pointed out to him that I thought that the English had a very good idea of how they trained lawyers, and I thought we could maybe adapt that principle to what we have in the United States. So Chief Justice Berger said he liked my idea, said, why don't you go ahead and see what you can find out about it? So I started talking with a lot of people, spent a lot of time, developed a process, and then developed the first pilot program for the American Inns of Court. And now there are 26,000 people in the United States, judges and lawyers, are involved in this process of trying to make lawyers learn the importance of how they function in court, civility, professionalism, preparation. It used to be that you learn from the person who you carried the bag for in the big firm. They don't have that experience anymore.
You're talking about the lawyers abroad?
Yeah, or no,
yeah,
here.
Yeah, here, yeah.
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 And so this was to take the place of that, and it's been very well received. We now have our first in overseas. I work with the Conference of Chief Justices of Asia and the Pacific. 34 chief justices representing two-thirds of the population of the world. We are going to have a presentation on in-of-court process for them this coming November when we meet in Ho Chi Minh City. And we hope now that this example that we've been able to show is successful in the United States can be exported.
Mm-hmm.
Lawyers need it everywhere.
Mm-hmm. And what is it about the process first at home? Is it having courses or people coming, lawyers coming or judges coming as observers to leaders in the field?
It's actually like an inn. There'll be so many senior people made up of lawyers and judges, so many in medium and some that are very new. They meet together and discuss these processes. They have pupillages, they have small groups and large groups. Mm-hmm. And then the younger people and the medium people, they phase out and they bring more people in. So it's not trying to lecture hundreds. It's just changing a few people so that good examples go into court. And that's the theme behind it, and that's what's working pretty well.
What is your idea about how this could help spread the rule of law abroad? Listening to you, I think you have a respect for the process of democracy, and it would seem that the process of democracy in different parts of the world are going to reflect national culture, political history, and so on. And so the question becomes, are there particular problems with teaching the American example with regard to law and the opera in different national settings? Obviously, that's a better way to go than to try to do this through military force, in my view. Talk a little about what the challenges might be there.
I've now worked directly in over 60 countries throughout the world on every continent where I've spent actual time with the judiciaries. And through international meetings, I've probably interacted with over 100. I don't try to sell the American model. The American model is wonderful for America, but it very often is not relevant to those individual countries. I may see something in Indonesia that I think is far more important. Or I was in 2 weeks ago, I was in Vietnam, and they were trying to develop a program, and I remembered a program I worked on in Nigeria that had a better model. Mm-hmm. And so that's the model that I recommended. So the idea is to try and work with these court systems to make them more effective, but based upon their religious, their culture and their local legal culture, and what fits best with them. And very often what we have won't. Then developing their judiciary so it's more effective, that they buy into it. It's their idea. They develop their judiciary. They draw up their lawyers. Then that is a piece of getting towards democracy. Obviously, I don't have any feeling that I'm changing the world, but there is a small area that I can be of help, and that is helping them to develop their legal system so it can take the place that a judiciary should in a democratic process.
I detect in all that you've said a philosophy of modesty and humility tied to intellectual rigor, if I can say that reflects the way you see the end of courts abroad, but also in the way you see the judiciary in our political system. Is that fair? I mean, you seem to recognize the limits of what courts do. And if that's true, do you feel sometimes that we overemphasize, that we think we expect too much of both lawyers and courts?
Mm-hmm. I do. And I think one of the things that I've always talked about is the importance of judicial humility. That is, the humility to recognize what our role is, and we shouldn't usurp the role of the political branches. And I think that that's true, that if we focus on what we were supposed to be doing, that requires the political branches to focus on what they ought to be doing. And I think that's true not only here, but it's true overseas. The best thing that we can do overseas in these countries, from my view of what little I can contribute, is to make their judiciaries more effective so that they are protecting rights, they're enforcing the Constitution. I always said the best thing we can do for a dictator is to give them a good independent judiciary. Mm-hmm. It'll take time. I mean, all of these countries are in transition. And in judicial administration, there are no Band-Aids. It takes years. Former Chief Justice Vanderbilt of New Jersey said judicial administration is not for the short-winded. And that's true. We're distance runners, and we talk in terms of decades and not years or months. But there are things we can do, and we should start doing more of them, to assist overseas the judiciaries and the lawyers to make them more effective. It's nice we're sending them guns and planes, and I think maybe that's important. But for long-term benefits, we shouldn't overlook the possibility of helping them develop structures which will protect human rights within the country.
Mm-hmm. As we think about the role of lawyers and judges in the future, it would seem that maybe we have too many lawyers in the legislature and not enough, you know, theologians and other educators and others who can bring different skills. So I'm curious about what you see as the overuse of lawyers. I'm not asking you to criticize the legislature, but clearly lawyers have something to add. But is it sometimes the case that too many lawyers is not a good thing as we're looking at different institutions besides the courts?
I don't know. I think we get there for a reason. What is there about lawyers that become politicians? Mm-hmm. And lawyers, of course, are focusing upon a very important process in the judicial system. So, and they do it on a daily basis, where a doctor is operating on a table, a professor was teaching in a school. But lawyers are right in the middle of this mix. And I think that it's just the very nature of the type of person who's drawn to the law and their experience of being constantly immersed in this process that sort of makes people gravitate towards that. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that we have too many lawyers. Maybe it's just that whatever they are, we need more statesmen.
Mm-hmm. Well said. One other area that I wanted to ask you about, we're in a kind of a foreign policy crisis now. We're also in an economic crisis. And so there's going to be a lot of looking back, you know, with regard to the economic collapse, a lot of cases coming before judges. And then in the war on terrorism, clearly, you know, there's a lot of rule setting. I'm curious as to what you see the role of the courts in dealing these two areas. We're really going to have a lot of new rulemaking. We're going to also have the possibility of investigations about, well, what went wrong, you know, what should we do about it, and so on. So I what I'm curious is, are there any red flags that you would like to hold up about what the courts can do and what they can't do, you know, and the contribution that judges and lawyers can make, even if we have a commission, say, and it's not thrown at the courts? On the other hand, all this may come before the different courts to solve different problems related to these two very important issues where we're really unsure about the way to proceed.
Mm-hmm. I think there are issues that are coming along the pike that are going to be that way. The whole idea of genetics is going to change markedly how courts function, what kinds of issues they're going to have to deal with. I was involved in a 3-year study on that. It was enough to frighten me. But I think that we have to be flexible enough to meet those that come along. They'll require judges to become educated in certain fashions, and to the extent that we are called upon to do it, we have to prepare. On the other hand, we can't use the judiciary as a universal fix-it. In the recent coup that took place in Thailand, the story is told of the king calling the judiciary over in a private meeting and saying, "Democracy needs fixing. You fix it." Well, we're not qualified either by our individuality or by our role to fix democracy. Over the long term, we can help it by not taking it over, but the idea to fix a democratic problem that they had there, we just couldn't do. And I think we have to be careful trying to give those things to the court. Very often, for example, in many countries, they get judges to be head commissions. Why? Because they think the people with the black robe on will be thought better of by the people. We did that once with President Kennedy's assassination, and the Chief Justice thought it was a great mistake, and he was sorry he ever decided that he would go along with it, because it changes the role of the judge, and we have to be very careful to do that. Now, England does it all the time, but it's not our philosophy. So I think we're going to have to be careful what role the court should play in these very important areas. Critically, we have to play the role of defending the Constitution. To the extent any of these things, the war on terrorism or whatever, is inconsistent with the Constitution, those cases have to come to court, and we have to be strong enough to make those decisions. No matter what the future is, no matter how difficult it is, the Constitution is so fundamental that we have to find a way of solving our problems without violating it. So the Constitution, I think, puts us in a position of having to be very vigilant. On the other hand, there are many things that could occur outside the Constitution, and the political process is going to have to sort that out.
One final question. If the students were watching this program and they look at your career and say, "Yeah, I would like to do that," how should they prepare for law in a world that's going to be changing a lot and the change we're already experiencing?
Yeah. I don't have any real answer to that. I think it's more a matter of interest. If a person really wants to come into law, there's so many different areas of law they can deal with now, not only domestically but internationally. And so a very broad educational process that gives a person a very substantial, wide-ranging experience will be of great help to them, because judges more and more now have to have peripheral vision. We used to just focus this way, but we've got to see what that means. We're going to make that decision having to do with the antitrust law, but what does that mean outside here? And we have to be able to see that process, that what that means. And I think to the extent that we get better strengthening of educational process, more in the liberal arts and that we seem to think is not necessary now. If it is 2 and 2 doesn't equal 4, we're not interested. I see it differently. I think we have to have that wider vision to bring to the task what's going to be necessary in the future, because truly it is going to be different.
Judge Wallace, I want to thank you very much for coming back to the Berkeley campus. Congratulations on your award, and thank you for being on our program.
My pleasure.
And thank you very much for joining us for this Conversation with History.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.